It's the Bert Cohen Show. For some people, I suppose, the dream goes on. Some people are very happy by the results of the election here that just happened all across the country on November 4th, 2014. Other people, it seems like the dream deferred. Well, I'm pleased to have with us in the studio a good friend, a person who, I don't know, you know, we must agree on some issues. I don't know
any. I don't think we do.
There's got to be something. I don't know, but she's a good friend. Alicia Preston, thanks for being here. You are with the Preston Group, and you've worked in a whole bunch of campaigns and do some radio stuff yourself.
I do. It's been a wild ride. Thank you for having me, Bert.
Well, sure. And I want to talk a bit about New Hampshire's politics as well as national politics. What do you think? Scott Brown, of course, he didn't make it. I am pleased that he didn't make it. You know him better than I do on a personal level. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of a factor Obama was. Were people voting, the people that voted for Scott Brown, were they voting for Scott Brown? Or I saw a lot of those signs, you know, equating Obama with Shaheen. And there, on election day, there was one that says, defeat Obama, elect Scott Brown. Was it Scott Brown or was it anti Obama, do you think?
I think it was a mix. I think for a lot of people, it was Scott Brown. He was more practical, more moderate than maybe some other candidates that have been put up before and was able to pull independents in that respect. And he's a pragmatic lawmaker. And I think a lot of people, myself included, when we cast our votes for Scott, we did it for Scott Brown. I think there's another component of the voting bloc that absolutely voted against the current administration and those who support it. And I can't underestimate the significance of Obamacare itself in that. And so therefore it's Shaheen's support of Obama and therefore let's go against that. But I think it was mixed electorate in their reasoning and a little bit of both.
Well, I suppose there's always many, many, many different factors in politics that make people vote for or against. I wonder how many people, I mean, to me, it looked like, and to a lot of people, it looked like he was here on a mission for his backers, the big banks, big oil, and of course, our friends, the Koch brothers. And that's, you know, the state didn't so much matter as much as serving those guys. What's your reaction?
I think the only people that believe that are the ones that are, like yourself, the liberal left, who weren't going to vote for him no matter what he said or did. I mean, realistically, I mean, the people who were undecided coming into it, the people who were in that, you know, 12-15% 2 weeks out, they didn't make their decision because, oh, if it weren't for the Koch brothers. No one in the streets even know who the Koch brothers are.
No, that's true. That is so true.
I got a kick out of the Democrats using that line so much in all their mailers and press releases. I'm going, nobody knows who the Koch brothers are. They probably think it's Coca-Cola, to
Absolutely.
Be honest. You know,
it's true.
And so I don't think that was it. I think that was an entrenched left of the base that had that opinion. I think this I think, you know, giving Jean Shaheen credit, she's got, you know, 30 years of goodwill in this state, too.
Yes.
And Scott is new to the state. I think Scott was doing it for the right reasons. But I think there are those who would say, I don't really know Scott. He hasn't been here very long. And, you know, I know Shaheen. She's been around representing the state for 30 years. And there is a familiarity issue there that those who weren't quite sure maybe about the policy or the politics went with what they know.
Yeah, that's true. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, we're talking politics for a change here, electoral politics. We do a little history. History is, you know, making changes. And this election is now history, the election of 2014. What do you think Scott Brown will do? Do you think he's going to stick around in New Hampshire? That's been one question I've heard on the left.
Right, on the left. No, I think I think he's going to stick around in New Hampshire. Look, he practices law in New Hampshire before he was running for office, and this is his home he's built now. And who wouldn't want to live in New Hampshire?
So. Well, that's true. I was at the Shaheen headquarters on election night and talking to some national reporters, and they were saying, this is a beautiful state.
Right.
They were, frankly, amazed. They were, you know, I talked to them, and they were like, wow, this is great. So it really is here. And, of course, Frank Ginta did win. What do you make? I mean, we had Jean Shaheen won. The red tide was kind of stopped at the border of New Hampshire. Well, except for in the state house, and I definitely want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But Frank Ginta beat Carol Shea Porter. Frankly, I love Carol Shea Porter. I never thought, and all, you know, when I moved to New Hampshire, yes, I'm a carpetbagger too. I moved here in 1981, so I'm a recent transplant as well. But I never thought I'd see the day where a member of Congress voted exactly the way I would want to vote on every single issue. Was it her? I thought she had some terrific ads. The numbers are difficult. They are in the first district as compared to the second district. Let's talk about the first district and then the second district. Why do you think Frank Ginta pulled it through?
Oh, well, first of all, Frank Ginta worked very hard. And I have worked for Frank Ginta. He's been a client of mine. And I saw Frank work as hard as I ever have.
Really?
To connect to the voters, to speak with them directly, to give them the right message, to be very direct with his opinions, his historical votes, his future potential votes. And he connected, and he worked very hard at making that connection. In turn, surprisingly, Carol didn't do that this time. And Carol was the person who did, you know, she was the activist. She got elected the very first time around
right.
by being an activist,
yes.
and having the people on the ground with her and connecting. This time around, she didn't do any, not one of those kind of events. She didn't get out there and reconnect with her electorate. And I really think that was, and I do want to talk and put all the big picture of why we lost most of the big races and won on the state level. Because I think the first district race is separate from the rest of the strategies that we can analyze around the state, because it was a matter of Frank worked hard to connect with the people. And for some reason, Carol Shea Porter didn't do that this time, which was surprising because that's how she's always won in the past.
Yeah, that is surprising. It doesn't really make sense to me why she wouldn't do that. I thought she had she's always had a terrific ground game,
mm-hmm.
but...
And not this time. And along the way, and look, I wanted obviously Frank to win, but
yeah, of course.
I look at things analytically, and I kept saying to people, why isn't Carol's ground game like it used to be? Why isn't this happening? What's going on? And I was very surprised that I was seeing this absence of activity. And so I don't know. I don't know what the strategy was or lack thereof, but I think that was more a win on logistics on both their behalves.
Interesting. And logistics are such a big part of it. In fact, I was seeing somebody, a couple of days before the election and the weekend before, there's always awful weather, rain and wind every time. And one of the most important parts of a campaign is sign maintenance. Not just finding the locations, but putting them out there and keeping them up there because,
mm-hmm.
oh my goodness. You know, and I don't know how effective those signs are.
I think they are first of all, I think they're more effective in a primary because you're still dealing with name
true.
ID issues. And I think while, you know, people say signs don't vote, they don't. But here's what happens. I'm an undecided voter. I'm driving down the street. I'm seeing a bunch of Frank Ginta signs and two Carol Shea Porter signs. I'm not saying that happened.
Right.
Using this as an example. Yeah. And I'm going, wow, there's a lot of support for this Ginta guy, you know, and I'm going to go with a winner. And that absolutely is a psyche people have, particularly the undecideds in the final days. And that's where signs show enthusiasm, excitement, and organization.
I've always been of the opinion that signs on somebody's property, they really say something. But these days, the past few elections, we've seen tons of signs on public property. I guess it's still name ID, and it does matter. Those things are, what is it, like $3 a sign or something like
it
that
these days?
It depends
where you get them. Signs are expensive.
Whoa.
Signs are very, very expensive. Oh. People have no idea. They're like, give me 10 signs. I'll see who I can give them to and where it's sitting here going. If we give everybody 10 signs and not know where they're going, that adds up to thousands of dollars very quickly. And people get frustrated and you want to explain to them. And they're thinking, this one sign's $3. What's the big deal? And you're like, okay, well, you multiply that by 20,000 signs and it's a lot of money.
And you know, if you give somebody 10 signs, some are going to stay in their basement.
Right. They're in the basement. Garage. They're in the garage. They're in the car. I mean, I can tell you on Andrew Hemingway's campaign, I controlled like a dictator those signs. And
good for you.
People would say, I'll take 10 signs. I'd be like, I'll give you three. You distribute them, come back, and I'll give you three more. And sometimes they wouldn't, sometimes they wouldn't. But I don't think we had any signs left unplaced.
Very good. Well, let's talk a little bit about the gubernatorial race. Maggie Hassan obviously won pretty easily. She, you know, it seems like New Hampshire Democratic governors have a tradition of governing from the center. They really do. You know, John Lynch was pretty centrist. I don't know if he ever campaigned for any Democrat. Maybe he did. He campaigned for some Republicans, actually, in the state Senate back when he was a governor. And Gene Shaheen, of course, was pretty centrist as well. And Maggie Hassan, yeah, pretty centrist there. Now, you had a fairly good, exciting primary for gubernatorial nomination, Walt Havenstein. Your candidate, Andrew Hemingway, who was in here, who's 32 years
32,
old?
32, yep.
What is the future of those two guys? Havenstein put in how much of his own money?
I didn't see the final report, but at least $2.5 million, I believe.
Of his own money?
Wouldn't it be nice? I think of this.
God.
It's not that you just have $2.5 million.
Right,
you have so much
nice
money, you're liquid enough to have $2.5 million in cash. Hey, he earned it. He worked hard his whole life. He was a successful man. And I'm a proud capitalist, so I'm not begrudging him. I'm just, you know, I want to be rich someday. I want that much liquid.
I know other people say different things. Guess what? I'm a proud capitalist myself.
Right, there you go.
You know, it's a good thing we have wealthy liberals in this world. I mean, Ted Kennedy and George Soros, people like that. You know, all
of
them.
I'm all for wealthy regardless side of the political aisle. So there you go.
May some of it go your way.
May some of it come my way. May you really wealthy ones hire me.
Well, true. Well, what's going to happen in the future, do you think, Havenstein and Hemingway? I think, I got to tell you, as a Democrat, I think Hemingway made a very, for the most part, favorable impression. He excited people. There's the young people. I heard different figures on young people coming out to vote. It was somewhere between 8 and 21% of those who could vote. That's pitiful.
That's,
I mean,
terrible.
It's just
terrible.
So tell me about Hemingway. What about his future? Did he connect with young people? I would think he did.
He connected with young people, with old people, with, you know, across the board. Our problem in the primary really was a money issue.
We just
didn't have the money to compete. And I Hemingway, with I think it was a $100,000 campaign, garnered 42,000 votes, which is,
that's not bad.
It's very, very,
that's pretty good bang for the buck.
That's good bang for the buck, and that shows that what he was doing worked. When he could connect with a voter, the voter liked what he had to say. But we couldn't compete financially. For Andrew's future, I believe is very bright and very strong. He is 32 years old. He's one of the smartest guys I've known. He's driven. He's creative.
He?
And he's not your typical politician. You know, his campaign was the platform was solutions first. And he is the only candidate I have known that released in a campaign so many detailed policy proposals that he did on everything from privacy to gaming to taxes to rooms and meals taxes too. So he's got a very bright future.
And those are some important issues, you know, privacy in particular.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know. I mean, Carol Shea Porter actually talked about that. I've kind of figured people, I don't know if they really care so much about privacy, but, you know.
And they care when it affects them, which is natural. When you hear that there has been a breach of records in government office A and your social security number may get out, you care. You care at that moment.
True.
And when you hear the NSA has spied on people with cell phones that have been involved in X, Y, and Z, and you've been involved in X, Y, and Z, you care. But it's a matter of people realizing just how constant their privacies are being invaded by the federal government, which it's evasive.
Yeah, and I can't help but think that's going to be a bigger issue as time goes on. So are we going to see Walt Havenstein around some more, do you think?
You know, I don't know. He really became a very good candidate.
He did. I have to say.
He just did. He started off a little shaky, but he'd never been in the public eye that way, and he was a CEO, but he had a great learning curve, and he became an excellent candidate. I don't know. I mean, I would presume that this is his first and last venture into elected politics, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see him keeping involvement in some other capacity.
That's probably true. One can do politics in other ways aside from being a candidate, him or herself.
And you can be an influencer and not be a candidate.
Hopefully this show is doing a little bit of that. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show today with Alicia Preston about the past election. She's probably feeling pretty good. My side of the aisle, not so good. We've had better days. But it's also true, if you look at history, and as you know, I love to look at history, not only in the U.S. Senate, the 36 seats that were up this year were pretty much almost entirely red districts anyway. And I have some, I got to dig it out here, some information about, in 2006, a similar year, the sixth year of George W. Bush's presidency, Republicans lost six Senate seats. In 1986, under Ronald Reagan, Republicans lost eight Senate seats. This year, Democrats lost, what was it, six, seven?
Seven, and I think there's one or two still undecided.
Oh, right. So there is kind of a tradition there. It's not so, unusual to have the party in power lose seats in the sixth year. How much of it was about, for example, Obamacare? It seemed to me that in the last month or 6 weeks or 2 months, there wasn't that much talk about Obamacare, but I don't know. My sense is Democrats were, I think, foolish not to stand up for the president, to just go with what they thought the tide was, what the mainstream media was projecting about it. I like this quote from my old Senate colleague, Wayne King. He said, "I hope that President Obama will stop triangulating and assert bold leadership in the last years of his presidency. He can start with something bold on immigration. Let's get this issue off the table and start moving the country forward." I got to tell you, that brings up a couple issues. One, running from Obama. Who was that? Allison Grimes down in Kentucky wouldn't say who she voted for.
Yeah, well, that was just ridiculous on all levels.
Oh, and she lost big.
She lost big. I don't think she lost big because of her connection to President Obama. She lost big because it was such an ingenuous, snaky thing to do by not answering.
Yes.
That's just unlikable. Like, I just don't like you because you won't be honest with me.
Oh, my God, I know.
And that it wasn't even politics or policy as much as personality. It was just cowardly.
Yeah.
Look, I think, there is a tradition of the 6 years of a presidency, particularly when there's been anything controversial. Under George W. Bush, it was the Iraq War. Under President Obama, it is the economy and Obamacare, of having a shakeup. It doesn't always mean the House and the Senate have control of one party and the president's in control, though. There's a difference between losing seats and gaining control. And I think, let's first, you addressed the Democrats running from President Obama.
Sure.
I think it was failed, and here's why. They had supported Obama. Their votes had supported Obama. You can't get away from that. The electorate's not stupid, so own it. I always tell my candidates, if you've got something, even a perceived flaw, but it exists, own it. Because it's yours. You can't get away from it. People aren't stupid. And I think by saying, I know I voted for everything the president wanted me to vote for, but I'm not like him, and I don't want him near me, it was cowardly. B, it tells the public, you're right, Obama's wrong. So Obama's wrong, that's why I'm not going to be near him. So come vote for me. Even though I supported him, he's wrong, I want nothing to do with him. And it just becomes this convoluted, well, if you don't want the president near you, why'd you support what he did?
Interesting.
And I think I think it was flawed. And I think, like I said, I always tell my candidates, if you've got something out there that's a perceived flaw, even if it's a connection to so-and-so, own it, because you can't get away from it.
And I'll tell you one thing. I've been in New Hampshire politics for many, many years, probably longer than you've been alive, actually. But people in New Hampshire, I got to give them credit. They have this, like, incredible sensitivity to authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
They really do. They take the measure of a candidate. I mean, in the next couple of years, the campaign 2016 has already begun, I'm sure.
Sure.
People of all stripes, left, right, libertarian, whatever, you can tell if somebody's for real or not.
Absolutely true.
It's so, and if you're running from it, you can tell.
You know, we
I
had
mean, it's so obvious.
Andrew was 32 years old, and we had so many people being like, "Oh, you got to like grow a 5 o'clock shadow, and you got to do all these things to make him older." And we would laugh. We'd be like, "He's 32. How are we going to hide this? We're going to own it, and we're going to embrace it as young, new, exciting, energetic." Like, it's just, it is. People are. First of all, the electorate is a lot smarter than many people give them credit for.
And they keep proving it.
And they keep proving it. They do indeed. And look, New Hampshire, you know, I wasn't as thrilled with the results in New Hampshire as I was nationally. But
I'm sure.
You look at the results in New Hampshire, it is proof of an educated electorate. Educated meaning aware of who's running, what's going on. And why I say that is because people clearly voted for Republican House members and crossed over and voted for whether it was Annie Custer or Jean Shaheen or Maggie Hassan. They took it race by race by race. Now, there are those like me who vote all Republican, but the masses looked at it very seriously, analyzed it, and picked who they wanted in each different seat. And that's proof of an informed electorate. I don't think they were necessarily properly informed on the top races, but that's okay.
I understand. But I also have to say, yeah, people get, you know, that authenticity. People have asked me, why do people vote against their own interests all the time? You would not agree with me that they do that. I you know, especially.
Well, I do agree they do it when they vote Jean Shaheen. But
too late. She won. I don't know if she, I mean, that is the best job in the world. U.S. Senate, my goodness.
6 years?
6 years?
You don't even have to look at campaigning for another five.
Oh, my. Well, she probably has some money left over. I don't know. But that's just a great job. And, you know, looks and how people look. People do take the measure of a person, male or female, and they can tell generally. People, there was a woman down the street from me who was voting for Hassan and Scott Brown. She voted for Scott Brown because he's so good looking. I had people.
He is good looking.
Apparently so. I don't have a good sense of what men are good looking or not. I don't know. I just
good
don't
looking
have.
Dude.
But I had, I'll never forget a campaign when I was running and a woman, I was at a factory gate. She looked at me and said, "I like your smile. I'll vote for you."
I don't think that's the same as good looking, though. That is a trust issue.
Oh, interesting.
The liking the smile isn't you've got pretty teeth and don't you look handsome. That's completely a trust issue. That's a different component than that's someone taking a read or a feel based on you. Whereas if someone says,
true,
"I'm voting for Scott because he's a good looking guy," that's different.
That's a good point. Now I feel better about that. I mean, I took the woman's vote, but, you know.
No, that's a trust issue.
That's a very good point.
Not that you're not a good looking guy.
Yeah,
you are that too.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying I like your smile.
No, that's a very good point. People, I think, really can tell about people. And outside groups, you know, I hear the Concord Monitor reported that third-party groups poured in more than $31 million into New Hampshire's Senate race. Outside groups spent nearly five times in 2014, the U.S. Senate race, compared to the last race. What about this outside? Is this something we're just going to have to live with forever? I mean, the Citizens United decision, people are upset at that. Some people said, well, why don't we just limit money to in-state money? And people, you know, some people wonder, what do you need so much money for? Well, those TV ads ain't free.
Right. And well, here's my thing. Well,
yeah,
before we get into the specifics, understand my psychology behind this, or my philosophy is that I do not believe in any of these controls. Does it make it an unfair base? Yeah, it does, because it means the rich are going to have more opportunity. Those who are supported by so-and-so are going to have more opportunity. But I think there is a bigger issue, and that is the philosophy of free speech. I think my right to give money, my right to take money, most importantly, my right to give money, any amount, whatever I want, I think is absolutely an issue of free speech. Does it, in the end, create an unfair playing field? Absolutely.
Sure.
It does.
No question.
But I think the philosophy of my right to give my earned money to whomever I wanted at any level is just more important. I think the foundation of free speech is more significant than that unfair playing field. The downside of freedom is you get a whole lot of life isn't fair. But the concept of freedom is just much more important. So I don't agree with. Mm. So look, even I got tired of the political ads. But I don't think we should do anything to control them. I think people will find out over the next decade or so that they're becoming less effective because there's too much of it. And realize, I think this is making us switch back to more significance in the ground game, because I think there's just a fog of advertising at this point, and people are becoming untrustworthy of it. So I think over the next decade or so, if things stay as they are, we're going to see an actual pullback of just massive media campaigning. I think it's flawed. I mean, I will tell you, I approached an organization in D.C. To help with the governor's race once Andrew lost the primary. And I was going to do it. We were going to do it to help Walt get elected. And we were told, and we had this whole strategy, which I think would have been very effective. And we were told they just do TV ads. And I was like, what do you mean you're just doing TV ads? Right. There's plenty of TV ads going on in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
This was a ground activity to generate the young people at college campuses.
Sure.
And Andrew and I spent a long time developing it. And the people that had the money in Washington in order to do it said, we're just going to do TV ads. We told them it was a bad idea. They didn't listen clearly, but my point is I think we'll see a change in that in the next decade because it's becoming less and less effective. There's just too much of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, neither of us, I'm Democrat, you're Republican, neither of us knows anybody who wasn't sick to death of all those ads. Right. Everybody hated them. The candidates, the campaigns were paying, you know, tremendous amounts of money the last like week and a half. Everybody hated them, turned off to them, didn't want to vote, hated them. And I can't help but think that you're right, that the money has to be invested elsewhere. It's like they had so much money, they didn't know what else to do with it. And to think that the only thing they wanted to do with it was TV, that's not.
And just for clarity, that was not the Walt Havenstein campaign. I was
working on
a third party thing.
Third party, yes.
Yeah, so.
People do watch a lot of TV, but there comes a point where it's like, you know, your cup runneth over.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets drowned out and there's just too much of it and there's no personal connection. TV ads are a good... in the primary, Walt Havenstein did TV ads. He did a series of them. He didn't oversaturate. We couldn't afford TV ads. It got his name ID out there. It gave people an idea of who he was. He was able to win the primary. That's effective use of television advertising. Yeah. The nonsense of the last 10 days prior to this, it was just too much.
Yeah.
One vote was changed in the last 10 days by those TV ads.
I couldn't agree more. I can't imagine, except maybe votes people saying, screw it, I'm staying home. I don't want to encourage.
Except those who blanked a ballot. Yeah, they went and voted for the House and said forget it in the other races.
I think it's probably true. People are just so sick of it. And the ground game is so important, possibly in New Hampshire. You know, in New Hampshire, we expect to meet. I mean, if you don't meet all the presidential candidates, you know, many times, you got to be hiding under a rock in this state. We expect people to come to us. We expect a ground game. Maybe it's different elsewhere. I don't know. But up to a point, I mean, I thought there were some terrific ads. I frankly thought Carol Shea Porter's ad about Ginta taking us back to the 50s was a wonderful ad. But it got lost in the shuffle. And how are you going to...
It all got lost.
And there was a local race here. There's also mailings. I have to go to the post office in my little town to pick up the mail. People were so sick of all the mailings that came. How do you reach through? How do you get to people? There's TV, oversaturated. The mailing, oversaturated. Well, you've been a political operative.
I think mail is one of the most effective things, if done right.
Be.
But, you know, the old adage, everything in moderation, nothing to excess, applies to everything.
That's a good point.
And I think you have to be very effective with your mail. I think you have to be... don't oversaturate anyone anywhere. And look, there's so many components to campaigns. There's phone calls.
Yes.
And people say, oh, we hate receiving phone calls. Phone calls, by the numbers, are one of the most effective tools there is.
Interesting.
There's mail. Huh. Used appropriately, it's very effective. Television advertising is great for name ID and to get your general message out. People, you have to see it 7-8 times to know what the full message is, but at least you get name ID and your traditional message out. Holding events that people can come to and meet you in person. That's vital. Those who are really interested will do it. And then earned media, you know, whether it's being on radio or news coverage. If someone reads a newspaper, they vote. Period. So every time you're in a newspaper, if that article is read by somebody, that person is going to vote. And that's where it's important. It's a micro target because everybody doesn't read newspapers.
Right.
But the fact is, if you read a newspaper, you vote.
That's true, I'm sure. Again, Bert Cohen here talking with my friend Alicia Preston, Republican. I'm a Democrat. I felt so badly. A friend of mine was running for county attorney. Very, very important race. Nobody pays the least bit of attention to it.
Mm-mm.
Hugely important. He had money for one mailing and one mailing only, and it hit, I think, the Saturday before the Tuesday. didn't matter. It was too late. It just got lost.
You only have one mailing. It was the right time to send it, though.
Yeah, I guess.
Get them at the last minute.
I don't know. And it was good targeted. It was targeted to independents who had voted.
Are you in Rockingham or Stratford?
Rockingham.
Rockingham.
Yeah. And, of course, this goes to Concord and Walpole stations as well. And just briefly jump the border, Maine. Elliot Cutler. Oh, my God. She laughs because Elliot Cutler elected LePage, Paul LePage. There's no question about it. I am just so furious at Elliot Cutler. People were saying, some people said, well, he's the only candidate worth voting for. Michaud wasn't so good. Michaud was a member of Congress. He was running for governor. Paul LePage is pretty right wing. He's been called one of the craziest, the craziest governor in the country, actually. But
he's a little kooky.
Yeah, he's a little kooky.
He's a little kooky.
And now Maine, because of this guy's ego, oh my God, just he elected this liberal, I guess, Cutler elected Paul LePage. And how often do you think ego? I mean, these candidates, people say, oh, all the candidates, left and right, Republican, Democrat, they're all just all about ego. I don't think so.
I don't think that's true either. I think these tertiary candidates who stay in the race, knowing they cannot have a chance to win, I think 1 in 50 of them are doing it to make a heartfelt point. I think the other 49 are doing it for ego. And I think it's not good for the system. That being said, the voters voted for him. What, did he get 9%?
Yeah.
The voters, 9%, cast their votes for him. And those voters chose to throw their votes away as well.
Yes.
Some of those voters did it out of some pure ideology. A lot of those voters probably just did it because, I don't like the other guys. I'm just going to mess it up. You know, and I think you have the right to do that with your vote.
Well,
I think it is an irresponsible thing to do with your vote, but you have the right to do it. But yeah, no, 49 out of 50 of the people that do that tertiary candidacy.
The Ralph Nader thing.
They do it for ego.
But what about the serious Democratic and Republican candidates? Are they doing it for ego? I really don't think so.
I'm sure. Of course, there are some.
Some.
There's always some. But yeah. No, the candidates I have worked with and been involved in or known, they do it for all the right reasons, more times than not. And I tell this to people, and I see the same on the Democratic side. This isn't just partisan.
Yeah. No, definitely.
And people be like, oh, they're all just crooked. They're all just this. And I'm like, you know what? They're not. They're just not. Are there crooked politicians? Sure.
Of course.
There are crooked waitresses. I mean, there's crooked everybody out there in some capacity, right? There's crooked everything. There's always
a
bad apple.
That's a very good point.
But
that's a very good point.
As it just happens to be that politicians, when they're crooked, it gets on national news.
Yes.
But most of them are good people. Most of them are doing it for the right reasons. And I can even say that about people I disagree with. I mean, our mutual friend, Kathy, in Concord, who just
Kathy Rogers,
who just won her re-election to
the
state house. She is a liberal nutbag. I love her dearly.
Yes.
And everything she supports that I disagree with, she truly believes it's good for the people.
Absolutely.
And most politicians are actually like that.
I completely agree with you. And it really bugs me when I hear people say they're all, you know, that's all they do it for, ego. When I was in the state senate for 14 years, every one of them truly believed what they were doing. They were doing it for the good of the people. Did I disagree with them a lot of times? Yeah, but they were doing it because they were sincere.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I completely disagree, they were doing it because they were sincere. It wasn't.
We just found something we agree on, Bert.
We did.
We did it.
Oh,
woo!
My goodness! I knew there had to be something. We probably like similar flavors of ice cream too.
Perhaps.
And there's a few restaurants in the seacoast.
Oh, definitely. We probably agree on that.
We're talking with Alicia Preston here, and it does just bug me because, I mean, I think it's people are doing it because they really believe in something. Well, it's going to change in Washington now. That is for sure. There's a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, and Republicans are going to head up key Senate committees, foreign affairs, the military, homeland security. Obama could just hand them the keys to the car and let them deal with Iraq, Syria, and Iran. It's always true that having been in a majority, sometimes in the state Senate, sometimes been in a minority, when we were in a tiny minority, it was so easy to give speeches and lose every single time because we were in a minority. But actually governing, that's more difficult. There's government and politics.
Oh, yeah. Two very different avenues.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's going to be more difficult for the Republicans now because we got some big issues here. What do you think is going to happen, say, you know, what are they going to do about ISIS and Iran and Iraq and things like that now? Any clue? I mean, they're in the driver's seat now.
Well, they're only so much in the driver's seat. Remember that they can authorize things, but the president is the commander in chief.
True.
So they are limited in what they can actually do. It falls on the commander in chief and President Barack Obama. And if they want the Senate and the House to authorize things, then they're there to do that. But that's pretty much the extent of their involvement in that level of foreign affair. Mm-hmm. You know, they can take up certain things such as immigration reform, et cetera, et cetera. But
right.
The president has made it clear, and I think we'll see if he doubles down or not. He has made it clear that he is going to use his pen when he can, which I'm not a fan of. I don't think that's what using his pen is supposed to be for. There are executive measures that he has the right to take. Creating immigration law is not one of them. And I think what we're going to see is we might see some chaos in the next 6 months. We might see some overreach from the White House and some serious constitutional pushback from the legislative branch.
Oh, my. You know, it's funny. People got fed up with Washington. You know, the popularity of Congress was, you know, I think just below the popularity of cockroaches. And yet most of them got reelected, which is pretty amazing.
Well, but that's an interesting thing. If you poll people, poll the same person and say, what's your favorability of Congress?
Right.
They
terrible,
say.
Terrible. But what do you feel about your own member
of
Congress?
What do you feel about your own member?
It's so true.
It's just how it works.
I know. It's kind of amusing here. But all right, Obamacare. What are they going to do about Obamacare, do you think?
I don't know. They're not going to go for a full-out repeal for the simple, well, they may go for it, but it's not going to get too far for the simple reason that Obama's going to veto it. We all know that. That's how it's going to be. I suspect they will go for a piece-by-piece removal of some of the more controversial or dangerous parts of Obamacare, which I hope they do. I mean, I support full repeal, but I also don't believe in exercises and futility. And so I think the most pragmatic approach would be to remove the parts of Obamacare that are most disruptive to the people.
No, they may be able to do that. I don't know. I mean, I feel like, well, that the insurance industry is way too involved in the solutions personally. But anyway, we'll see what happens to that. There's also, immigration. That's going to be an interesting thing. Talk about the veto power. I remember, I don't know if you were even born when Gerald Ford was president. He used a lot of vetoes. He vetoed, and he didn't get reelected. They do use their veto pen sometimes. I wonder how confrontative they're going to be right now. You know, Obama gave a speech the day after the election, indicating he's going to try to work with them. How?
There wasn't a lot of love in that speech, though. I mean, come on.
You have a way with words, Felicia. That's good. Yeah, no, there wasn't. I wonder if how possible it's going to be to work together on immigration policy, for example.
I predict they all spend the next few weeks playing nicey-nice, and then stuff's going to hit the fan.
Right.
They're all going to try. But look, they don't like each other. Mitch McConnell and Barack Obama are not buddies.
No.
Barack Obama, what did he say the other day? Someone asked him something about Boehner, and he said, oh no, we're friends, we've golfed together. I mean, they golfed together 4 years ago. We're buddies. I golfed with them 4 years ago. I mean, so I think everyone's going to try playing nicey nice, see if they can make things work. And it's not going to happen, and then things will blow up.
Well, one of the issues that I mean, 2016 has already begun, you know, and it seems to me, maybe you disagree, but that one of the issues is that I think is going to keep rising is the income inequality, how it's at least as bad now as it was in the so-called Gilded Age in the 1890s, that there's a few people with tremendous amounts of money and a lot of people. I mean, the middle class is basically, you know, wiped out. There's not much of a middle class. They've all either gone to the lower, you know, working class category or a few to the upper. I wonder about tax reform. People have been concerned about offshoring process. American companies can claim foreign ownership through mergers and send their, you know, offshore the profits. What do you think about this issue? Do people care about this? I would think that maybe some Republicans might care about this and shipping jobs overseas. You know, that's, I would think,
well,
an issue.
Let's look at why. Because the cost of doing business in the United States is too expensive. And so we can criticize the corporations that go put their factories in Mexico or Brazil all we want. They wouldn't put their factories there if it was cost effective to have them here. And those American companies do have to apply not by the labor standards of those countries.
Right.
I mean, they can't pay 7 cents on the hour. They have to pay what is considered reasonable wages. And so if we reduce the cost of doing business in the United States, businesses will stay here. It's easier to stay here. It's in their other cost to going overseas. But look, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We have the second highest regulatory system when it comes to burden in the world. It is so and then you add things like the not knowing what's in the future. Where's this going? The lack of visibility. Our laws are changing constantly. The outcome of Obamacare. What's going on with the tax structure? What's going on with immigration, which has a tax factor? Then the individual states. There is no visibility for these companies to know where they're going to be in 5 years if they stay and build in the United States. If we can reduce the regulatory burden to reasonable levels, reduce the tax burden, which is the highest in the entire world. And I don't think people realize that. It used to be Japan, and Japan lowered theirs after the tsunami, I believe it was, after a tragedy they had over there. They lowered their tax burden. So now we're the highest. Excuse me. We need to make the business climate in the United States more manageable, and companies will be willing to stay here. But we can't just say, we know it's going to cost you six times as much, but...
So I take it you're against raising the minimum wage then?
Yes. I don't believe in a minimum wage. I don't believe in a minimum wage. I keep talking about philosophically.
It's good to see we still disagree about
something. That's nice. And my philosophy is this. I believe, and it goes to being capitalist and a free market person, no one's taking a job for $2 an hour. So you can't offer $2 an hour because it's cheaper to take unemployment. It's more lucrative to take unemployment or welfare or whatever benefits there are. So there is no market for employees for $2 an hour. So that's not going to happen. And I believe the free market, 9 out of 10 times, works itself out. And I don't believe in creating laws to prevent the 1 out of 10 times when that can harm other things.
I can see why campaigns hire you. You're good. You know, I happen to think we need a better infrastructure, our electrical system, our highway system, our transportation system. A lot of people are looking for jobs. I'm kind of a Keynesian. What can I tell you? Mm-hmm. You know, hey, we do have our differences still.
But keeps it fresh. That's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And energy policy. Is climate change doing anything about climate change out the window now? Is the heat all going to go out of sight of the building?
Heat's going out of the building. You know, I don't know. Energy is such a complex issue. I think we have to, I think the Keystone Pipeline is huge. I think President Obama is going to be pushed now to take action on the Keystone Pipeline. Many Democrats in Washington support the Keystone Pipeline. I think that's one thing we're going to see change. I think that'll help.
You think that'll be approved?
I think that will get approved. It may be danced, it may be changed a little, but there's... Not only the Republicans being in control, there were enough Democrats that now I think the president's going to be pressured to get that Keystone Pipeline coming in here. But we have to look at energy costs. I mean, New Hampshire has some of the highest electricity rates in the country. And again, it goes to regulations. Why can't – and I think energy costs can be affected much more on a state level than a federal level. In New Hampshire, you know, that Ruger, for instance, has this big plant, and behind them they have this raging river. On their property, in New Hampshire law right now, they're not allowed to put a hydro plant there. Now, if they could build it themselves, they could self-contain just in the river on their own land. A hydro plant, which is great for the environment. There's no bad there, right? New Hampshire law won't allow them to self-energize. Why not?
That's a good question.
Why can't they self-energize?
Oh, my goodness. There must be some good reason. I can't imagine.
I understand.
What better way to generate electricity?
What better way? It's clean, it's efficient, and it would be cheaper for Ruger to do it that way, but they're not allowed to. That law needs to change. I understand if your plant is on top of a coal mine, you can't just go down there, dig it out, and throw it in a furnace. Right. I get that. But we're talking about reasonable energy policy, hydro plants on someone's own. People should be allowed to self-generate. I think the energy issue and the cost issue is a state issue as opposed to federal, though.
Well, interesting. And that's something that I tend to depart from many of my Democratic colleagues, in that, you know, I like the idea of decentralizing power and decentralizing decision making.
Mm-hmm.
People most affected by decisions ought to be able to participate, have meaningful participation
Absolutely.
In that decision making process. And one thing that I wonder about as we look toward 2016, there's been populists on the right for quite some time. We have a couple of populists now, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are talking about, I think, some issues like this. I have felt for a long time that there's a potential link between kind of libertarian populists who want to keep some degree of local control and not have, you know, central Washington telling us everything to do, leave it up to the states. I mean, the states have been voting on, you know, same-sex marriage. The same states have been acting on legalizing marijuana. I'm pleased to say that's one of the good outcomes of the election. And I think here in New Hampshire, what a fantastic way to generate revenue. We'll get there eventually. And I think it's better than gambling myself. But I wonder about any possible link between, particularly with young people, libertarian populists and progressives like Elizabeth Warren and Sanders. They're talking about real issues, I think. And you're not going to have Hillary Clinton talking about real issues here. I wonder if there's some potential linkage that could be strong.
Well, I mean, there's an old political theory that the political spectrum is not a line, it's a circle. And that when you get to the far right and the far left, they meet.
Yes.
I'm not sure they do. And here's,
I don't think they exactly meet, but
because how they got there are by two very opposing views. And so even if you want law A to be passed, if your motive for law A to be passed is different, then that whole philosophy is kind of blown up. I don't know if I see a connection between libertarians and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. In large part, look, Elizabeth Warren, you say, is a populist, and she wants people to have these individual this and individual that, and she votes for government control, and she supports Obamacare, which is not a libertarian self-control type of piece of legislation. So they say we want to give you the right to choose for yourself, to make your own decisions, to do whatever. And yet the votes say we want government to do it because we want you to, but in case you're not able to, we'll do it for you.
Interesting. Maybe, I mean, I like the idea of instead of, you know, one size fits all, maybe regional buying groups, like for healthcare, you know, like
voluntary. Look, I'm self-employed. Why not? Why can't I pool with eight other self-employed people? I am the face of, I liked my insurance and I liked my doctor and I couldn't keep either one of them.
Hmm.
And why can't I? And my insurance is incredibly high now with a $5,000 deductible, $55 copay, and only 60% prescription coverage. That's what I have now. And I pay $400 and something a month. So, but why can't I pool with nine other small business people?
And if you could have,
and buy insurance.
And you could have various, enable various groups to form, voluntary
yeah.
groups to form and buy insurance. You know, maybe a New England, you know, single payer, not a nationwide single payer, something like that. I mean, I think.
Well, I think then there is no New England government. So I think you'd have to get six states to agree and that ain't going to happen anytime soon. But I think if you could volunteer, and look, this would be run by the insurance companies. And I know people don't want to give faith in them, but
that's true.
If the insurance companies were told, if they were allowed to, and Anthem comes out and says, fine, I'm going to do a New England regional pooling, then 10 business people in New England get together and they go buy a pool insurance from Anthem. It would be cheaper.
Well, I think profit should be taken out of the insurance industry altogether.
I think it depends what they do. If they pass legislation, control legislation that the masses of this country believe in, then yes. If it is complete gridlock and nothing gets accomplished, then no. So I think we have to wait and see. We have to wait and see what the leadership in the House and the Senate do. We have to wait and see how far President Barack Obama goes with his executive orders and what the legislative branch is willing to do to push back against that. 2 years is a really, really long time.
Oh.
I have no idea.
Well, as we know, 2 weeks is an eternity
right.
in politics.
Absolutely.
Things can turn on a dime, and you never know what's going to happen. Interesting how Ebola suddenly isn't an issue anymore. I'll just leave it at that.
that fell off.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I hated to see that using fear. That did bother me tremendously.
Do you know what, though, on this, and I think some things I said were misconstrued. The nurse in Maine. So I don't think there, and I think the court probably made the right decision by saying there's no legal right at the moment to quarantine her. If she had Ebola, I think there's a legal right to quarantine her, because that's a direct threat to the public.
Sure.
But here's where I'm disappointed in her, and that's where people need common sense. Why didn't she just stay in her house for a few weeks? And actually, by the time she got back, it was something like 13 days. Why does everybody, not everybody, but so many people right now, they just need to make a point. They just have to make a point in everything they do. The right thing to do as a human being is understand you're causing fear. Do fair or unfair, you are.
Yeah.
So why not just be a nice person, stay in your house for a couple weeks and say, you know what, I don't want to scare people. Whether that fear is right or not.
Aside from that, I think there was a certain candidate who mixed immigrants with ISIS, with Ebola, just to...
Who?
Scott Brown. I really didn't like that. Oh, I didn't like that at all. All right, another interesting figure, Ted Cruz. I mean, here you got the majority. You know, when we had a majority in the state Senate, the Democrats did. You think we could agree on anything? We couldn't get anything done because, you know, it's so much easier to be outside. But when you're inside and you get somebody like Ted Cruz, he has, it seems to me, he has an ego and he doesn't want to play ball with anybody here. Is he going to, you know, throw a monkey wrench into the works, do you think?
For the presidential or for the...
For the presidential as well as for the Republican Senate working together.
I think Ted Cruz, my perspective, and I do not know the man, I think Ted Cruz spends a lot of time making news.
He does.
And
he's very good at it.
To make news, you have to be controversial. How does that play? I don't know. It worked well for Chris Christie for a couple of years.
It did.
I'm not sure Ted Cruz is the Chris Christie style, but I don't know how it's going to play. You want if you want to get yourself in the news a lot, you make controversy, and Ted Cruz is good at doing that. Is that a good strategy for running for president? I don't know. If he keeps it up, it could rabble rouse in the Senate a little bit, and we'll have to see how it turns in the electorate.
But he doesn't. My sense is, they don't like him. I mean, you know, it's interesting. In the 1980s, when I was first here, the Democrats, we were, you know, not agreeing. We weren't, you know, we were kind of, so there was some warring amongst ourselves. Now I'm seeing it amongst the Republicans. There was some worry that since Scott Brown was quite possibly pro-choice, I don't know, that he wasn't.
He was pro-choice.
Okay. And he wasn't as strong on the Second Amendment as some gun groups would like,
mm-hmm.
that there was concern that some Republicans would think, well, he's not pure enough, I'm not going to vote for him. And I wonder, you know, how radical will the Republicans be now in the U.S. Senate? Will they go to the right? Will they try to, you know, really outlaw, you know, abortion, stuff like that? I know that's an issue.
Oh, none of that's going to happen.
You don't think so? The social issues not going to happen?
No, social issues aren't going to happen.
Smart.
No. I would be floored.
Yeah.
And it would be stupid. And yeah, and look, yeah. I'm personally socially conservative.
Oh,
but
I understand. I respect that.
I want to win in 2016. And yeah. It would be really stupid if the Republicans in Washington decided to go very right on social issues. It's not going to happen. Mitch right. McConnell won't let it happen. That would be foolish.
He is a smart guy.
I mean, it's kind of like when, and I am pro-life, but when the Republican Party a couple of years ago upped the ante in their pro-life platform, the national, it was like a month before the, or 2 months before the general election, they had their, you know, during the convention, and they went even harder line on abortion in their platform. And I'm like, now why would you do that right before the presidential election? Like, it just lacked.
That's not where the country is.
That's not where the country is. And why do it strategically now? Like, it makes no sense at all. It was poor strategy. And I'm speaking as a pro-life woman.
I understand.
I think it was stupid strategy. Wow. So, you know, it's like the mainstream country is not voting on abortion.
Social issues.
Or social issues at all.
Gay marriage. Who cares?
Gay marriage. No, people are not voting on this except extreme right and extreme left, where that's all they care about.
That's true.
And that's a very small, small number.
Very small. So, I got to ask you now, you're a Republican consultant. You try to help Republicans. So this is probably a ridiculous question to ask you. The Democratic brand, should we become more like Republican light? Or do you think we do better as, you know, out and out progressives?
I think I consider Barack Obama a progressive, and I think he won for a lot of reasons the first time. And that was, he inspired people. He offered hope.
Yeah.
He was a very good candidate. I have to give him that. And I think people enjoyed that inspiration. And I think that had a lot more to do with his election than policy, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a good point.
But I don't think being hard left or hard right is going to win in 2016. And if we were to have a very liberal and a very conservative as the two nominees, I don't know what would happen.
I
think people should look to represent the masses. I'm a big believer in the Reagan 80% rule. And the Reagan 80% rule is, if you are 80% my friend, that doesn't make you 20% my enemy. And it's a very good rule. And too many people on the left and the right say, oh, I love him, except he voted against this, so I'm not going to support him.
Right.
And then they stay home, as you mentioned, the Scott Brown stuff. A lot of people did that, which was too bad. They didn't vote in the Senate because of one or two things they don't like about him.
Mm.
And that happens on both sides. I think the person who can win the presidency in 2016 will be the person who shows he best represents the largest group of people to the most manageable percentage. We've got to stop being ideologues if we want to succeed.
Well, we will see. Fascinating discussion. Thank you for your analysis. I always appreciate it. Alicia Preston, if people want to check out your website.
My website's down right now because it got hacked a week before the election.
Oh, no.
I lost my email. I had to shut my website down to get control of it again so that people couldn't do things to it. It'll be back up as soon as I have time. It's AP at the Preston Group. ThePrestonGroup.org, but I have to get it working again.
ThePrestonGroup.org. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thanks for being here.
looking for his freedom and a life of his own. But the freedom that he found wasn't quite as sweet when the truth was known. Is awake and can see, and until her conscience has been found.